Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is co-host John Holt.
Hello, welcome to me.
Hello. Well, welcome, John, welcome. This is your first time on Sophomore Lit, so could you introduce yourself to all of our sophomores out there?
Hey, so I am I'm an animation producer nowadays. I used to direct kids animation for TV, and now I produce animation mostly for commercials and TV packaging, and some stuff for the web for YouTube. So I did a long film that actually kind of ties into this for a hedge fund manager, Ray Dalio, about that was laying out his thoughts about the past, 300 years of economic history and how he uses that in his hedge fund and economic philosophy to talk about the future. So it's this sort of economist view of, oh, look at what colonialism and and the rising dollar has done across these different empires, Dutch to English to American, and who's going to be next?
Well, that does sound relevant to this this episode's book, which this time we are doing Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, 1899. It was originally written, collected in a book in 1902. One of the most assigned books, I would say, in English literature. What's your history with this book?
When I was a sophomore in the early 90s, and so that's about the same time that the Heart of Darkness documentary that Eleanor Coppola handed over to Hickenlooper and Fox Barr to put together in 91, that was hitting Showtime around just like about that time. So it was hitting the video stores. And so rewatching Apocalypse Now and reading this and kind of getting into that, it was on the recommended reading list, but I had already gone down the rabbit hole of reading this. And it was part of my, you know, exploration of that period of writing, you know, reading Dr. Moreau, reading some Kipling, which was that was a little more like class related. And then from those, the people who kind of jumped from that point, like Lovecraft in some ways kind of touches on this stuff. So there's that's sort of my take on it and where I approach it from. Like I was reading it while I was in late middle school, early high school, and living in a town that was a shipwright town. So I grew up in Duxbury, Massachusetts, which is part of like the Plymouth County, which is where, you know, down the street from us, they've since renamed it, was Plymouth Plantation, maybe 15-minute drive from our house. And a 1 mile from our school was a bay and homes of various people who had made their fortune having stepped off the Mayflower and built ships and laid transatlantic cable and basically then made cranberries and all the things that make a fortune in a new colony.
I live in Boston, and I do know Plymouth Plantation and Duxbury. Plymouth Rock, which I think I've covered before on this podcast, there is no real evidence that the Pilgrims actually set foot on that rock. In fact, it seems kind of counterintuitive that someone would pull up ashore and step onto a rock rather than to a beach or something. But it's still there to this day. It's a fun place to visit. I'm embarrassed to admit that this is a book I have not read until now. I have studied other Conrad in grad school, and I knew about this very well. You know, I know about it as you do via it's being the inspiration for Apocalypse Now, and it's such a well-known story and so central to all these histories of literary modernism that it's sort of like Casablanca. By the time you get around to seeing it, you kind of know all the best lines. But I have to also say, I've been told what this book was about for a long time, and reading it through for the first time myself, I'm a little bit unsure of some of the pat answers people give about what this book is about. We'll get into that.
This is 1899. It's set in a period when it was the age of new imperialism and neo-colonialism, specifically with the Belgians. And you had this, you know, these conflicting ideas of ideologues who were going in to be white saviors, but also this, like, who also held in the same time these thoughts of, like, oh, well, colonialism isn't that great, or imperialism may not be that great. So there was these, like, opposing ideas. And so you had this sort of, like, humanitarianism combined with these people's still working through and still holding a number of prejudices. So I think one sort of important thing to note is that this book uses words that are, you know, expletives. And this book has been put up on obscenity lists and stuff for using the N word and for how it portrays people. And it's been, you know, it deserves a look at, you know, this is a colonialist portrayal of, and a European portrayal of other people and a lot of othering. And so it's, like, important to see it from that perspective and note that, like, Conrad was a complicated person and he's representing certain people, and, like, it's, but there are, you know, it's of its time and there's a lot of complication. And I think it's important to, like, couch it in a little of its history, and the complexities of what is, you know, to our current sensibilities and lack of, you know, our knowledge, the ignorance of the time, but they were trying. And so you can give them a little of that too.
Yeah. I think, a lot of literature, you have to disentangle what the character's points of view are from what the author's point of view is. And this book makes it harder than most, because this book has a double framing device. The main character of the book, Marlowe, who is through most of the book the first person narrator, is presented at the beginning of the book telling his story to a group of men who are gathered together at the Thames. They're all in some way or other involved in the maritime trades, and they're discussing the history of seafaring, the history of colonialism. We're given introductions to three of those people. The fourth person is ostensibly the actual narrator of this book, who is never named, who never interjects his own dialogue or opinions, other than in the sense of the collective we of these four people listening to Marlowe's story. So you have that level of narration on top of Marlowe telling a story, on top of the fact that this is ostensibly a story of memory from many years ago. And so teasing out what Conrad himself is up to can be a little bit tricky, I think.
Yeah, certainly. And I will say, too, there's a little bit of, to take it to the writer's stage, he was in contact and communication with H.G. Wells and loved the time machine. And this is in this narrative device is an honor in some ways of the time machine. And I will note, too, there's another book that was a serialized story that came out around the same time as Heart of Darkness called Lord Jim, which is a pretty well-known, another, like, much adapted tale, also about sort of a colonial white savior, also starring Charlie Marlowe as a ship captain. So this character, you know, like a Philip Marlowe to come, was a recurring character. And in Lord Jim, it's even more complex, where Marlowe is telling the tale to the ostensible narrator, and then in turn starts handing the narrator letters And so he's telling the narrator about these letters, who the narrator's and reading these letters from other people's perspectives. So you're getting this whole story around this character of Lord Jim and his, you know, rise and fall and his redemption arc, effectively, and how he's saving this group of people in Indonesia. But it's an even more like interwoven and complex narrative structure that he had been playing with, and again, he had pointed to his love of the Time Machine's use of the same device and in how he approached Heart of Darkness.
I thought of H.G. Wells when I was reading this story. I did not know that Conrad was a fan or knew Wells. But it struck me that I've previously on this podcast, I have read War of the Worlds. And one of the things that's interesting about War of the Worlds is, while we today think of it as primarily proto-science fiction, this kind of important work of early science fiction, in its time, it was part of what was called invasion fiction, which was a whole genre in Victorian in England, which was about some foreign power coming and invading. And it was about the anxiety of empire, basically. You know, we went off, we colonized the world. What's going to keep someone from doing that to us eventually? And there are lots and lots of these forgotten novels typically about some European force coming in and occupying London or whatever. But Wells reimagines that whole genre through the lens of an alien invasion. And the reason that I was thinking about this is Conrad is writing this in English for an English readership. He's writing about Belgium, although Belgium is never explicitly named, and of the way that Belgium was in the process of completely subjugating and strip mining the resources from the Belgian Congo at this point. And that's not actually named either. We have the river, the Congo is named. By talking about Belgium, Conrad can write for an English audience, and the audience can sort of look at it from a distance. Whereas if you were writing a story about, say, the exploitation of the subcontinent, the audience might be less prepared to listen to that.
Yeah, certainly. And this is also around the time, because, you know, he was a sailor himself, Conrad, until he couldn't... he could no longer, like, do it because of his health, effectively, and kind of shifted to writing. He'd met writers on his various tours. And he had done a stretch in the Congo. In fact, that's where he met Casement, Roger Casement, who was working on a railroad in the Congo and was tasked by the British government to put together a study about what was going on, what Leopold and his crew were doing there. And actually Casement's paper ended up being a huge expose that the American papers picked up, and was this anti-colonialist and pretty heavy condemnation of Leopold and the Belgians at the time. And so that sort of flavored this tale as well. They're, you know, they're in parallel. They're both telling stories. One is literal, like, reporting on the ground about the atrocities being perpetrated in the Congo, and the other is the sort of the Upton Sinclair against meatpacking version of condemnation of it. But again, pretty like you're noting, done not insidiously, but like insinuated and trying to sneak around people's sensibilities to insinuate his ideas in their minds. Because, you know, Conrad being a Polish Ukrainian who yearned to return to Poland, but it was still like parceled out between three other empires, and so there was this anti-imperialist movement to try to free Poland at the time, and he had that nationalism and wanted, you know, a Polish nation and wanted to return to that unified home. His father was an anti-imperialist, but he ended up staying, you know, kind of becoming an English person and set his stakes down there and became an English author. Wasn't actually, you know, sort of took him a little while to even get his career going. So it was later in his life that he was a writer.
English was his third language. He knew Polish and he knew French growing up, and he didn't start writing in English until his 20s, which is astonishing to me because I read a lot of books for this podcast. This is a very well-written book. This is a beautifully styled book, and Conrad is aware of a lot of the ambiguities of English. That's sort of what Conrad's whole shtick is playing with irony and ambiguity until the reader is left to really puzzle out what exactly is happening, what exactly is meant by what's happening. In that way, Conrad reminds me of like Nabokov, another guy who learned English and then became one of the greatest English stylists. I can't think of a third person who's like that, I guess.
I mean, if anything, there are people who are native English writers or speakers, but they come at their work from the position of they're in love with the language itself. And so that's their, you know, like a David Foster Wallace or a Pynchon or someone who is so playful to the point of like, you can tell when they're dialing up the convolution, they're dialing up the complexity, which Conrad is doing in this tale of, you know, it's a short book, but there is a reason why a lot of people have trouble getting through it. You know, it's what, 77 pages, depending on the edition you're in, or 100 pages, but it's written intentionally to be something to like churn through, to like, you're working your way slowly through it, much like you'd be working your way slowly upstream in the Congo or trekking 200 miles through the woods.
I have tried in the past to read this book, and I wasn't not enjoying it when I started reading it. It was more like I never got around to finishing it. I would read the first 10 pages, the first 20 pages, whatever, the first 30 pages. One of the things about the way that Conrad writes is he writes so that interior dialogue, external action, exterior dialogue, they're all presented on the same level. It's hard to express, but as I was reading it, I had that uncomfortable feeling of not exactly knowing. I know that we've changed our location in the last two sentences, but not exactly sure how or when or why, you know. Or Marlowe has been sitting there ruminating on history or ruminating on some aspect of seafaring, and then suddenly we're back into the ostensible plot of the story, and you kind of miss where that transition is. There are transitions. And I wouldn't call it stream of consciousness, though. It's not like reading Joyce or something like that, or it is dense. It is dense. And, he uses some variant of the title Heart of Darkness, maybe four or five times in this book to describe different actions of people proceeding into increasingly dark situations, whether those are literally dark situations like going into a jungle or metaphorically dark situations.
I'd say maybe too, there's an intentional sort of dreamlike quality to it where he only names maybe five or six characters in it, and three of them, like there's Kurtz, you know, the titular, like not titular, there's nothing titular about it. The character who is the focal point, the character that he's going to. There's Marlowe, the teller of the tale. And then there's like maybe three other characters. Feverschlen, the guy who was Marlowe before Marlowe set out, who is a bit of a like cautionary tale. This could have happened to Marlowe. He could have gone from being a quiet, introspective seaman to beating someone to death on the shore and ending up with a spear in his ribs, kind of thing. And no one is blamed in either direction in that retelling. It's just sort of something that happens to people out in the jungle. And then the other couple characters are named characters. One is the author of a book about sailing, which just they happened to find in a hut in the middle of the jungle upriver. And then one other person who's just casually named offhand. But for the most part, everyone else has, like, they may gain a name like the intended or the manager. But no one has, or the bookkeeper. But it's, again, it's like telling a dream where you're like, this is a, there's a being whose essence I can put a name to, but there is no name for this thing. And so you can barely hang your hat on it, and it might shift. There might be three managers over the course of the tale with slightly different motivations. And as you go from station to station, it just becomes intentionally, I believe, more and more difficult to unwind and hang yourself on things.
People are described functionally. They're described by their job title, or they're described if they are Native African, they might be described as cannibals. But there's the Russian, this wandering Russian who's just called the Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And even early on in the story, Marlowe, when he's looking for a commission, Marlowe has worked in the merchant marine for a while. He's not had any luck getting a new job. And he decides out of nowhere that he wants to go to the Congo for no reason other than he sees it as this mysterious new place in the world that was not on any map when he was a child. So he goes to Belgium, you know, again, not named, to just say they go to the continent where a couple times it's mentioned that people speak French. And he has an aunt, I believe, who gets him the job, but she isn't even named. His family members don't get names. They're just there to be plot devices.
And her plot device brings in an interesting quote that I quite enjoyed. I'll bring it up here. She said, she talked about weaning those ignorant millions of their horrid ways till, upon my word, she made me quite uncomfortable. I ventured to hint that the company was run for profit. So it's this weird thing of, like, what are the justifications for the very thing? So she's pushing hard for him to get this commission, because she, like, you know, he's going to make his, she's going to, he's going to have this noble goal in her mind, which is, you know, to Marlowe at least, positioned as terrible. And but his justification is just a layer of, well, you know, it's for money, it's for profit, you know, we're helping the company, you know, stake its claim.
A lot of this book is an examination of what exactly is Europe doing to its colonies, and why are people there? And the thing about Kurtz, who has been sent there by the unnamed Belgian company that seems to be mostly in the ivory trade, is he has been positioned up the Congo at one of the stations along this trade route, and he's seen as very efficient and very good on the field from the company's perspective. What makes him good is he is effective and he gets the job done, meaning keep the natives down in any possible way that he can to promote the company's interests. But he becomes a liability to the company when word comes back that he is behaving eccentrically, that he seems to have cut himself off from other Europeans, and that he is doing what a lot of people are, like Marlowe's aunt, want the Europeans to be doing. He's bringing what they see as civilization to an uncivilized people. He's doing it by setting himself up as something of a god king. It's so strange and so contradictory, even to the point that before we ever meet Kurtz, we see a pamphlet he's written about bringing civilization to the masses, and it's written in enormously pious language about, you know, civilizing, bringing religion to Africa, and then it ends with this statement of, like, they must all be exterminated. So there's even before we meet Kurtz, he's presented as this sort of schizophrenic vision of Europeanism.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, spoiler alert, there's a note that he does hand this pamphlet over later on, but tears off that addendum, tears off that, like, that last little bit Marlowe does in that. I do want to, like, it's interesting because looking at when I was reading about Casement and Conrad and a couple other their sort of compatriots at the time, like E.D. Morrell, who was an anti-slavery, like an abolitionist for the Congo. That was his big campaign. And he wrote a pamphlet about that. Their initial thought as they were both sort of forging their way into the Congo, Casement again is a railroad person who's also commissioned to write this study on how the abuse is being leveled against the Congo, which is more of like a hit piece against King Leopold. But him and Conrad sort of had this notion that like European colonization would bring moral and social progress to the continent and free the inhabitants from their, quote, slavery, paganism, and other barbarities. But Conrad himself and Casement both had that notion flipped for them and lost, you know, they believed that colonialism and imperialism was not the way to save these people. They didn't have strong answers to it, but they knew something wasn't right there. So it's sort of interesting to see that tension in Marlowe, who Marlowe is a pretty in like go with the flow, like quite literally survives because nothing sticks to him. He just kind of floats through the tale, doesn't get too sick so that he does, you know, he doesn't die of illness, thankfully for him, I guess. But he doesn't, like, none of the horrors touch him deep enough because he doesn't let himself think about it too much. Is sort of the how it comes across a little bit, that he's able to float his way safely in and out of the tale, so that he can tell it, and still won't even except in the darkness on the Thames when he has to stop and have a quiet moment. Only then will it start to, like, he'll start to think about it and ruminate.
Marlowe is a guy who takes the longest view possible of things. I mean, he literally starts the book discussing London as having been a colony of the Roman Empire. And he does that to express a certain amount of humility at the idea of civilization at all. You know, he's saying, you know, it's not, I think the one of the things that before I read this book, a lot of people said, well, this is a critique of European colonialism. As I read it through this time, actually for myself, what struck me is that Marlowe's concern about colonialism feels more to me like he recognizes at the beginning when he talks about how London was once one of the dark places of the earth, and when he talks about civilized people coming to England and what that must have been like, he says, you know, that we who think of ourselves as civilized, we're living in this flash of lightning, this sort of like momentary flash of lightning. He goes, and sure, may it go on forever, but he knows it isn't going to. The whole idea of civilization to Marlowe is something of an illusion. And as I read it through, I got the feeling that his main concern about Europeans exploiting Africa, Belgium exploiting the Congo specifically, is not so much what is being done to the indigenous peoples, but the way that this is affecting the Europeans, that the Europeans are becoming coarse and vile, and they, if they think that they're going to come in and civilize people or give them the true religion or whatever, really what's going to happen is they're going to go upstream and go crazy. When we started this, you were talking about the criticisms people have of this book from the standpoint of the way that the African characters are portrayed. And I know that Chinua Achebe, author of Things Fall Apart, had a whole paper he gave about why this was a terrible story, that we should throw it aside, you know, because it's a remnant of really ugly colonialism. And then people who support Conrad are saying, like, well, you can't confuse the actions of the characters with Conrad's attitudes. I think that in some ways the the African characters are there more to again move the plot along, or to kind of prove a kind of an ironic point. You know, Marlowe refers to his crew when he finally gets his steamship dredged up from the water. It's capsized, and he gets it up and he gets it going down the river to go after Kurtz. There's him, there's a manager, and everyone else on the ship seems to be made up of the local population, and he keeps referring to them as cannibals. And that at first I was like, this is terrible. This is like, you know, this is really a Europeans, you know, casting aspersions on the local population. Then I did a little bit of research and I found that cannibalism was widely practiced in the Congo at this time. It is, of course, I still think unacceptable to refer to these people functionally by one cultural thing that they do, but it seems like Conrad has them there to contrast the fact that these people are competent, they are loyal, they are funny, and serve urbane in a way that the Europeans aren't. So they're kind of there is a kind of a weird juxtaposition of civilized, uncivilized there, but the categories again are very European and very dismissive of the African population.
Certainly. And I mean, he does, you know, he'll call them woodcutters at times, because that's what the other job they had was, to cut wood or watch the steam pipes of the tin pot ship that he had going up there. But he also had the pilgrims. I'm not justifying how he cast people, but the other group that he had on the ship of white people were these kind of like Keystone Cop pilgrims who would just grab guns and shoot out in the woods and laugh, and were kind of like another, almost like a zanier juxtaposition to the staid cannibal crew of woodcutters that he had. So there's this, like, he trusted one over the other for sure. But yeah, I think that there's something to be said again for seeing what the perspective of people who were colonizing, like seeing how they saw people, how they saw even their own people. You know, there's a group that he doesn't really enjoy at the central station who go off into the woods on some treasure hunt and are swallowed by the foliage, like they were going into the sea, like divers into the sea. And, you know, the word comes back that the donkeys have died, but he says, but no word had come back about what happened to the less valuable creatures that had gone out. So kind of saying, like, you know, life is sort of cheap in the Congo for them, and how he interacts with people and talks about people. And even when he's using the expletive, the N-word, it's that broader sort of term that, you know, it could be used for anyone in India. It could be used for anyone in Africa. It's a sort of like blanket caste term as much as anything. And then sometimes he'll use terms that distinguish certain groups, and then he'll even, Marlowe's this complicated character where he'll say, well, they called them enemies here, and then criminals here, and then something here, you know, and savages here, as if like there's a bit of disdain for someone categorizing people like that, where he himself is doing it the entire tale, is blocking these people, almost giving no one a name, and just sort of saying, well, these are these people, and that's what they're dealing with, like othering loads and loads of characters throughout this book, in especially the people of Congo, the indigenous people, and the people who have been brought in as from other parts of Africa to basically wither and be used up through legal time contracts.
Yeah, the one thing that really surprised me reading it through for myself, rather than having people describe what the book was about, was how very little screen time, per se, Kurtz gets. He's built up and built up as this crazy character who has this gift of a voice, is what they call it, that he has some weird charisma that not only appeals to the natives, who are setting him up as sort of their ruler out there in the jungle, but to this this Russian guy who they run into, who says, you know, Kurtz enlarged my mind, and he talks about him with enormous respect. But he also sees, but even the Russian guy sees him as crazy and a danger. And so we're being set up to, like, boy, when we finally meet this Kurtz guy, he's going to be something. He's going to be something, you know, big. And then for the time that he's actually pulled out of the little village he's in on a stretcher, because he's already very sick and near the end of his life, to the time that he dies, I don't know, it's like 10 pages or something like that. It's like it's very brief, and he doesn't say much. He tries at one point to escape Marlowe, and Marlowe tracks him down and brings him back, and he's kind of pitiful in that way. So he keeps saying, oh, if only I had more time, then you'd really have seen something. Like, what exactly was it that he thought he was going to do beyond what he'd already done? This sort of implication that the next thing was going to come. You know, he's sort of become this, I don't know, this cult leader, this Jim Jones character.
Initially, you're sort of a question mark, because they've built him up. In fact, he even jumps time. He jumps ahead in the telling of his passage to Kurtz to sort of talk on Kurtz. Like, he can't wait to get to talking. Marlowe can't wait to get to talking about Kurtz and his experience with Kurtz. But again, like you're saying, it's still painting the contours of this great man, with the, you know, and everywhere along the way, it's just these people telling the tales, you know, of the great and powerful Oz character at the end of this, you know, twisting golden road. And when you finally get to him, they don't even make it explicit. There's just a figure is drawn out by whom. You have to, like, reread a couple times to be like, okay, the pilgrims brought him out on a stretcher from behind the house, and the native people, the indigenous people who he's sort of got a power over, are not very happy about this. And so it's this tense moment, but it's not even explicit immediately that this is Kurtz in the stretcher. And so you have to kind of go and puzzle that, even that moment out. And then when it's finally revealed, he's, you know, massive and tall and more of a horror figure than anything else. This, like, scary, emaciated, his head is described for the longest bit of time. And when he starts to speak, he's off on the shore. He can't hear him directly. So he just says, oh, he was yelling at that point. Like, he had opened his mouth, and whatever words are lost in this image, this, like, Munchian image of this scream, sort of mouth eating the whole world with its, like, you know, another Heart of Darkness moment where he opens his mouth and it's this gaping black hole ready to consume the world. That's the first word from Kurtz, is this, like, silent black hole of a mouth, really. And then there's a point where he goes back and forth, Marlowe, about Kurtz, and it's not even that exchange where he's like, I'm going to bash your head in or do something to you with a rock, or I'll beat you with my bare hands. They don't even get into how he subdues Kurtz and brings him back to the boat. It could be implied that he you know, serves more injury onto him, and in turn that might sort of have accelerated Kurtz's passing. So he's sort of skirting around the fact that Marlowe has purported that he's not a violent person, but again, he's not a reliable character narrator in this. But then, you know, Kurtz, you're still getting Marlowe's impressions as reflected from the manager, from the other characters who are interacting with Kurtz. And it's the very few are these moments where Marlowe and Kurtz directly interact. In fact, the one sort of direct exchange is when Kurtz is dying and the candle is right by his face and he's talking about all he can see is darkness, the horror. And Marlowe's like, okay, yeah, whatever. Like that, effectively paraphrasing, he uses fewer words than that. But that's it. That's the last moment of exchange. He goes and sits down and eats dinner because Kurtz is dead. But he still keeps his fate tied to Kurtz, perhaps because this person left an impression and because it makes his whole journey mean something if he hangs it on this like massive figure that he had built in his head all the way up there for months while he was waiting to fix his boat, for instance, at that one camp. And now that he's coming back out of it into the real world after the sort of fever dream moments, again, it's just there is so little Kurtz that it's more like Marlowe built this thing in his mind of this one being. It maybe, again, Kurtz could represent the idea of, you know, of the great exchange, like what colonialism could do, what we could accomplish. You hang your hat on that, and then when it doesn't bear fruit, you're sort of stuck with nothing. You have nothing, and so you just have to make something up to justify what you were doing. And to the point where, and this is kind of telling to you, there's a moment where he talks about lying, where Marlowe talks about lying and how morally it's the worst thing. Like he doesn't lie. Like it's foul in his mouth. He won't do it. It's just detestable. It's the worst thing you could do. You may as well just kill yourself if you're going to lie. And the last thing that he does is lie to the intended, which is Kurtz's widow, intended betrothed, his bride to be that he has died on, who's still in mourning. He lies to her and tells her that Kurtz's last words were meant for her. But that's still a lie. So he's still like, he relinquishes his morality to protect the image of this being because he's telling this tale to these people to keep this character going, who, again, it's all built up for us, for the viewer, for everyone. And it's the same story that he started telling us that, you know, this is a circular echoing tale, things happening over and over and over. It's all this sort of recursion that I quite enjoy about this story. There's so much in these 70 something pages.
Kurtz's final words, the horror, are probably, if you haven't read this book, you've probably heard some riff on that, some either parody or reference to it. It's probably the most famous line from this. And after he dies, at first, Marlowe is a bit dismissive of Kurtz. You know, up till now, he's treated Kurtz with a certain amount of contempt and has not taken the fact that Kurtz is dying seriously. He sort of thinks of this as like, oh, this is affectation. You know, I thought Kurtz was going to be this great guy, and he's kind of a whimpering guy. After Kurtz dies, everyone's running off to attend to the body. Marlowe finishes eating his meal, and it's the ultimate kiss off to Kurtz. I can't even be bothered to stop eating. But after that, as he starts to ruminate on Kurtz's last lines, there is this extended discussion in which Marlowe talks about his own attitude towards death and the way in which he's dealt with it, or the way that he's approached death in this sort of highly intellectualizing way, and trying, he describes it as the most boring fight one could imagine. He grows to admire Kurtz for having this honest response to mortality. That's sort of like he's raging against the dying of the light, basically, And Marlow finds that increasingly appealing as he ruminates on it. After Kurtz's death, he falls under the spell of Kurtz. And you mentioned he goes at the very end to Kurtz's fiance, who at this point must have been waiting for him a very long time up in England. And when she talks to him, she talks about what a great speaker he was, and how Kurtz really could have been something, and said he should have been a leader of politics. And Marlow says, well, for what politics? You know, what side would he be on? And she says, it doesn't matter. You know, what matters is he had this voice.
And particularly an extreme party, too.
And it is weird, yeah, as you say, that Marlow lies to her to protect her feelings. Kurtz is presented as this madman who's doing very bad things to the people that he's subjugating. But he's also incredibly attractive to everybody around him. And why that is isn't clear. You know, this is where I think as a reader, you want to step in and try and create some explanation for it, that people admire him because somehow he's outside the system, or he's either outside the system or he's the perfect distillation of the system. You know, in some ways, what Kurtz is doing in this little town that he runs is in miniature what the whole Belgian company is doing to all of the Congo, but he's just being explicit about it. You kind of, as a reader, I find myself trying to come up with reasons for why Marlow ends up under Kurtz's spell. I don't think Conrad really gives a clear reason. And this is part of one of the things that I, as I finish reading this story, I start to really question everything about the story, whether or not, you know, that's when I started to think, yeah, Conrad does have contempt for the way that the Europeans are exploiting and these people under the guise of civilization. But I think, you know, ultimately he also has this greater contempt for the whole idea of civilization. And maybe Kurtz is a genius because he's able to break the game, I guess.
Sort of. Well, I guess like a question would be, it's what is Kurtz exactly doing? Like, is it a Rousseau situation where basically Kurtz, they believe there is no social inequality, and it's when Kurtz brings social division, basically, and inequality to these tribes, and has one that he's using as his own personal war band, that's the horror that you know, it's this, that Rousseau is right, that humanity is inherently good until civilization is brought to bear.
You asking me?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's like it's an open question, right? Like, I don't know, because it makes me think of another, you know, Lord of the Flies, another sort of sophomore lit style book, or maybe a little bit younger, but this idea that, you know, that's when they start to introduce you to like Hobbes versus Rousseau. And even in there, they'll kind of tell you like, oh, Hobbes believes people are inherently evil. But he means that in that they can't govern themselves. Like, they need to be governed by something. They need a structure or an order. And Rousseau in turn believes that people are inherently good. It's when structure and order and, you know, the rise of an agrarian capitalist society that breeds the dark things in man. So it's a sort of this twist that, you know, is he playing with it? That's another thing, too. What was Kurtz doing out there? Was he actually, had he, quote, gone native and was, you know, actually just working with these people and being part of their society, and that was the issue, that he wasn't subjugating them, that he wasn't doing the things that were expected of him to wring out profits, but that he was defending these people and basically paying out of the system to keep them safe, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, it is unclear what was actually happening here. It seems the implication I feel from the company's standpoint is they're fed up with Kurtz because he seems to be taking some of the profit for himself. And especially when they talk about this trade in ivory, it seems like he's amassing some wealth to himself rather than sending it on down the river. So that's what they're really angry about. From the standpoint of me as a reader reading it through, there is this implication that he has set himself up with at least one concubine here, and that he is exploiting the goodwill of these people. And it does seem like he has made himself into a leader. Now, I'm predisposed to look poorly on that because I don't like colonialism, and I don't like the idea that white people are going to go in and solve these alleged problems for black people. And I've read enough stories in which someone takes advantage of, say, a technological difference and is able to convince a group of people that they are worthy of adulation or worship. But I don't know for certain that that's what's happening here. It is very unclear. Kurtz is able to stir up his followers to attack Marlowe's ship as it comes.
Yeah, and there's even sort of this question, because there's a little bit of a back and forth. It's like, oh, were they attacking to stop him? Like, initially they're like, oh, they're attacking because they don't want you to take him away. And then at least the Russian tells you that, oh, Kurtz said they should attack you because he doesn't want to be taken away. This sort of, at least through the Russian's POV, he's painting this picture of Kurtz as a dragon on his hoard, that it's his ivory, that even when the Russian tries to get his slice of the pie, Kurtz is like, no, that's my ivory. I've done all the work here. Give it over. And there's no, except for the Russian, there are no other white people at the station. So, what is their fate? We don't know. I mean, ostensibly they could have died in the jungle, but Kurtz could have had them taken care of to make it easier for him to do what he needed to do, whatever that was.
I just don't know what Kurtz is going to do with all that ivory. Is he going to, start making pianos?
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of sitting on this wealth because you're told that it's valuable. But he was still sending the most ivory down the coast of anyone else, maybe because, he found an efficiency and was using his war bands to make sure no one else was sending any ivory. So whatever he sent, whether it be a pittance, was still more than anyone else could send.
It's not entirely clear why the company wants to remove him as the story begins. They obviously seem to have found him to be a liability of some sort, even though, as you say, he's producing all this ivory. Perhaps it's the fact that he is successful in actually doing what Marlowe's aunt says that Europeans should be doing, in imposing some sort of European order onto the indigenous people, and there's this feeling that perhaps they will become independent and break off from the network of stations. I don't know, but see, that's me again writing in a story. That's what this book does. This is the experience I had of this book. Is this is a book that leaves an enormous amount out, but it's the stuff that you absolutely have to come to a decision about if you're going to make any sense of the book. And that's the game of the story of this book. And that's, I guess, what people really admire about Conrad is, again, ambiguity.
Yeah, and you can pick this book up, and depending on where you are in your life, or, you know, in your own education, you're going to find something else in this book, or find a different, either a different perspective or a different truth in it for yourself. And that's another reason why I think it's pretty powerful, and important, probably, for younger people to read it, so that when they're older and they reread it, they have that moment, they have that revelation that good literature can have multiple sort of meanings as you age with it. You know, the Apocalypse Now into being a retelling of this tale, and then Heart of Darkness being like an echo of this tale in the documentary retelling of the story. But it also, you know, a similar sort of thing that I enjoy quite a bit was the, like, Fitzcarraldo, and it's paired documentary about making an ill-fated film in Burden of Dreams, which is itself about these characters kind of going mad, and they both focus more on these, like, megalomaniac Kurtz style characters. In Coppola is, you know, how benevolent is he, and Herzog or Kinski, depending on who you're looking at in Burden of Dreams. And I find that, you know, I find sort of that pairing, if you were to, like, rabbit hole, for me it's reading Hearts of Darkness, going and watching Apocalypse Now, and it's paired documentary. Then for again another, like, person trying to conquer the native land as a white person, you know, literally putting a steamboat over a mountain, in Fitzcarraldo, and then Burden of Dreams, the tale of someone trying to make that movie. All of those, I think, package really well together. And that would be my recommend. Also, go see Dune, because again, if you want to talk about a look at, like, colonialism, the mythology of the white savior, and how you can manipulate superstition to your own ends, and, you know, who should have that ability and power, you know, is Paul Atreides, Kurtz, is it his terrible purpose to to do this, to get the ivory, aka spice, out of the heart of the desert?
Thanks to my co-host John Holt. The Sophomore Lit theme song is by Malcolm Nygaard. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. And if you want to, you can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com.
Okay, I think we'll end there, because I can't think of anything else to do.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.